Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere across planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. I got to play a little bit of AC/DC because I usually do these shows very early in the morning, and it's pretty early in the morning here in Chicago. That along with some Dead River Coffee. A little AC/DC, a little Dead River Coffee. They kind of mix and mingle, get the wheels moving a little bit quicker, and hopefully the show turns out a little bit better. I'm glad to have you joining me. I'm excited about all the time I get behind a microphone. It is a magnificent obsession for me for the last 25 years. There's a part of me that, you know, I have no idea where this goes in the world. I mean, I hear back from people from time to time. You know, every time I get an email or a Facebook message, I should say, because that's mostly how people find me on Facebook, from like Scotland or somewhere in the UK or Australia or Cleveland. Doesn't matter where it comes from. I always kind of think about it's like, you know, throwing just out into the wind, the virtual wind when I do this show. Very different than being on the radio in a defined space like Chicago, for example. I've done that and many other places I've been where you're on from noon to three or two to four or whatever it is. So this is took me quite a while to get used to how people listen to podcasts. So this show is being done on a certain day, but it goes into the archive, and I'll get an email or a Facebook message 6-8 months, a year later after I did a show, and someone's just listening to, for example, just the other day, I got an email, again, to be clear, because that's what, you know, broadcasting all about. Got to have that full disclosure. I got a Facebook message about Dr. Jane Goodall, who I spoke with 3 years ago, but it's still there. And delightful message from someone in California about how much they enjoyed it and, you know, that it's timeless. And, you know, again, you kind of realize that there's a body of work out there that's easily accessible from anywhere, and the technology that makes it possible is just still a bit mind-boggling to me. I have a lot of mementos in my office, my studio slash office, and one of them hanging up on the wall right over here is a cap from my grandfather, Carl Gustav Bengtsson, my mom's dad, and he worked as a bus mechanic at Greyhound Bus, and he's this really cool Greyhound bus cap with his name inside. It's in perfect shape hanging on the wall. And every now and again, when I come in to do this show, I wonder what he would think about this, about how this mechanism works and all the pieces, and that it goes out to the whole world. My grandpa Carl died in 1965 and got to see none of how the world is today, but so much of, I think, how I see the world to some greater or lesser degree comes from him. He was a huge influence in my life. He's a guy who came from Sweden when he was 17, 18 years old with almost nothing, like a lot of immigrants did, and built a life. And that work ethic to me has always been profound. It stayed with me no matter what I've been doing for a living. And now, of course, radio for 25 years. So to me, it's still the bring your lunch bucket to work mentality no matter what I'm doing. And what I've been doing this past week is connected to the show today in a direct fashion. So I've written 3 books. To all the people who taught me English over the years, they're probably really surprised to believe that I could do this, but it's been an interesting experiment, if nothing else. Never sought out to be an author, but yet when I look at the breadcrumbs going back, growing up, my parents were voracious readers. We had this enormous bookcase in our front hallway from floor to ceiling that was probably, 6-7 feet long and about 1,000 feet high, as I recall. Just filled with books of all kind. And, you know, he had to walk past it 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 times a day. And I can remember my dad getting ready to walk to the bank about a mile away from home. Boy, those were the days. He just would walk to the bank for work. That was his commute. He would walk to the bank at Six Corners, and sometimes he'd come home for lunch, but he was always back by 5:30 every day. Just a very different existence than I have. But he'd always be pulling a book out of that case. And I can remember having breakfast and sitting at the table when he was getting ready to go to work, and he'd either be putting a book back or pulling one out, and often he would say to me, "You might want to read this." Never once did my dad or my mom tell me to read anything. So my curiosity got up, and I started reading, you know, everything they recommended, all kind of books. My favorite group of books was called Childcraft. And they were short stories about people and places and events and stuff that I thought were fantastic and just so vividly written. And I think early on, these stories of Ray Bradbury were just a huge influence on me. And I realized as I become a writer and an author that I obviously don't write what Ray Bradbury wrote. There's no science fiction to this stuff that I do. But it's his ability to take short stories and say so much in a short amount of time stuck with me. So while I've been hacking away at some fiction pieces for years, the books that I've written that are nonfiction about my life and the memories that I have and the adventures that I've had and the experiences I've had, I've really worked to keep those down to, you know, a readable level. I don't know that you have to work hard to read. I never thought that was a really good idea. And I want to spend 3 months reading a book. I want to spend about 3 days and then I'm good. So that's how that has been written. And first book came out in 2007, Living an Uncommon Life. Second book came out in 2010, Every Moment Matters. Third book came out in 2018, 2019, Phenomenon. And they're all out floating around in the world. The first two books are, quote, out of print. Everything that's being sold now, I mean, I have a few here, but they're basically out of print. So there's nothing new being cranked out. And probably 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago now, I guess, I got the publishing rights back to my first two books. And it was a little bit of doing, and I was wrangling with all that, but that's for another time, or not at all. But I got the rights back, and which means I could basically go through the printing process and recreate those books, because as it is now, every book that's sold online from Living an Uncommon Life and Every Moment Matters, the first two, I don't get a dime. I got paid up front years ago, and unless I reissue these books, you know, I don't see any money out of it. And that's okay, because part of, I think, at least for me being an author, is you know that's going to happen at some point. It's an interesting process, to say the least, the publishing business and process. So that's kind of how those two sit. Phenomenon is available, and I do get earnings off that. So go buy Phenomenon if you haven't. It's not hard to find. You can get it at Lulu, which is the publishing page that I do, because I created this book. I published it myself. The first two Hampton Roads published. But this was my first solo effort to publish my own work. I've done it for other people, but this Phenomenon book was my own efforts. And what I decided to do, instead of reissuing Uncommon Life and Every Moment Matters in print, I'm going to put them both in audio. So a couple things happen. I have more control because I control those pieces. And plus I would earn off those. So everybody who buys them, instead of me, you know, getting nothing out of it, at least there's something there. And it's a whole lot easier, I'm here to tell you kids, to do an audio version of a book I've already written than trying to recreate it. So at least I know that they'll all be in audio, and that's a very good thing. And the other ones are in Kindle as well. Well, I don't think they are, actually. The first two books are not in Kindle anymore. If they are, I'm not seeing a dime from them, and I have to investigate. But I misplaced the files for Every Moment Matters in Uncommon Life, the actual master files, about 3 years ago. And I've been looking for them for the last 36 months. Easy 3 years. And, you know, my mind plays tricks on me. Like, well, I think I put them here, and I think they're over here. And it turns out, you know, I have these little glimpses of what I saw when I was reviewing them, and they were on a disc, a CD. And I have, oh, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 CDs with all kind of shows and music and a ton of stuff on them. So I must not have marked it clearly when the CD came from the publisher, and it's gone. However, late last week, I found it. I decided I'm going to go through every CD I have. There's, you know, easy ones to take out, which are the production ones that are all in hard cases. And then there's a slew of these ones that are paper sleeves and what have you. But anyway, I found it. And I was overjoyed because I found things in the last month I thought I'd never see again. And when that happens, I feel like my brain hasn't totally fallen out of my ass, which is a good thing. So I find it. I get in there. I start going through it. And I decide, okay, let's start cranking this up. So in order to do that, of course, it's a script. And I'm reading a script and creating an audiobook, which they'll probably be out in summer and then maybe early fall. The process of creating the book for me is about a month, depending on how much time I spend, you know, cleaning it up and recording and re-recording and things like that, getting it where it needs to be. And then there's the whole mechanics of it. There's the whole platform that has to be built, and you go through all that, and then the editing process. So anyway, by the time that's all done, and then they review it at Audible, it could be 4 months, easy, which is not most efficient thing, but it is what it is. So rereading these stories that I wrote well over 10 years ago has been a very interesting experience to me. My life has changed dramatically and drastically since those first two books were written. The I Believe Every Moment Matters, I'll be putting in a bonus chapter, because a lot of what I talk about in there and some of the people that are in that book, they're no longer here. I'm glad I am, but they're no longer around. So there'll be some sort of an update with that, because it is, quote, dated material, but it is still evergreen in the fact that the what I'm hoping to convey in there can sit on a bookshelf, and 50 years from now, somebody can pick it up and go, oh, thanks, that was pretty good. One of the chapters in there that I just read is called The Corner. And it recounts my time as a kid growing up in Chicago, especially in 1969 when the Chicago Cubs were running for the pennant. And it was a magical summer for me. You know, I'm 11 years old. You could go to Wrigley Field at that time for 10 bucks. I mean, the whole day, seats, hot dogs, Coca-Cola, and, you know, some ice cream, and you're good. And then make it all the way home for $10. That's back in the day when you take the bus up Addison to Clark, and then Clark walked down to Wrigley Field, and then sit outside the left field bleachers for a buck to get in. Man. Anyway, so I recounted a lot of that in The Corner, that chapter. And one of my guys and one of my heroes and a guy I've stayed in touch with for decades is Randy Hundley. Great guy. He was the catcher for those great Cub teams, and, you know, talked about the interaction I had with him. But one of the other guys that was really prominent, and it came back to me when I started going through this, was Ron Santo, the late, great Ron Santo, the third baseman for the Cubs, 13 years with the Cubs, and then he played a year with the White Sox, which was like akin to sacrilege back in the day. But, you know, he was a guy who was basically the captain of the Cubs. He was all-star many times. And Ron died in 2010, I believe, and then 2 years later he was inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. So he didn't get to see that. His kids did. And I did quite a few projects over the years with Ron Santo Jr. And so anyway, all this is swirling around and swirling around as I'm reading this. And listen, I admit to the fact that I don't know that I'm a really great, I'm not a great writer. I think all I'm able to do is take some emotions and put them in the simplest, plainest language I can come up with for a couple reasons. One is that's how I read. And I think that's the most effective. I read some stuff that people write. I'm like, man, it's like they're painting with 19 colors. I don't have that in me. I try to keep it as simple as I can and as visceral and gritty as I can, because I think that's how my life is. And that's how what I relate to. But I also got emotional going through some of this stuff. Not that particular chapter, but some of the other ones. I'm reading things that I, again, have written 10, 12, 13 years ago and reliving them as I'm speaking them into this audiobook. That really surprised me. So this process has been very interesting. And when I took a break from recording a couple days ago, I thought, now I got to go find this conversation that I had with Ron Santo, which would have been in 2007, 8, or 9, somewhere in there. And the way that happened is that at the time, I was at Oprah Radio, senior producer for the Dr. Oz show, Gene Chatsky, Bob Green, a couple other shows, and I had my own show on the channel. But when Dr. Oz would come to Chicago, we would make every attempt to have live guests in the studio with him. And of course, everything at that time for him was around health. And full disclaimer here, look, I know that Oz is running for Senate in Pennsylvania. I haven't talked to Mem and Oz in years. The guy that I knew back then was a stand-up guy, enjoyed working with him, kind of, you know, bullheaded, but geez, so am I, so we got along real well. Went on to television and all that stuff. And so, I've gotten a couple messages over the last few months. You know, can I get you Dr. Oz's, you know, email or phone number? No, I'm not going to do that. And number two, I have zero opinion about what he does or doesn't do in politics. I don't live in Pennsylvania. End of story. But for these purposes, when Oz was doing the radio show, as I said, he'd come to Chicago to do the Oprah show, and then we would knock out five or six shows with him in radio when he was here. And I thought, getting Ron Santo in to talk with Dr. Oz about overcoming diabetes as a baseball player would be a great conversation. And by then, Ron's name had become synonymous with the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. And what started out as him just helping a little bit became a huge deal with the Ronsanto walks every year in the fall and raised millions of dollars for diabetes research. So this is the setup for this clip that I'm going to play. The first part of the show, Oz was in the studio with Ron, and they talked more in medical terms. And at one point, I'm recalling this, again, this is quite a while ago, Oz had to go across the street for the Oprah television taping. And so I handled the last part of the show, or the third segment, I believe it was, more from a Chicago standpoint, as someone who's very familiar with the Cubs and all that stuff, and talk about that chapter that I had was working on. And then the book wasn't even out yet. You know, I was recounting to Ron this corner that, you know, we all stood on. It was fantastic. It was Berto and Keeler. All the Cubs had to stop there before they got on the Tri-State Tollway heading out of town. And we stood there with pen and paper in hand and mitts and baseballs, and our heroes would stop and they'd be like within arm's distance, like Glenn Beckert was right there. And then Randy Hundley had his Corvette and Ron Santo had his Mustang with his Budweiser hat. And these were guys that were, you know, our heroes, and they were heroes on TV and they were heroes from left field. But man, when you weren't at the game, you could stand on the corner and they'd stop and sign for nothing. Now you got to buy stuff that has autographs on them. So it was a very, very special time. And so for me to be able to come in and introduce Ron to a big audience, the Oprah audience, was a lot of fun. And he's a dear man. I'll talk a little bit about that on the other side of this. Enjoy.
You're listening to Oprah Radio.
Learn how your body really works from the inside out. Here's Dr. Oz.
We're back. It's Oprah Radio. Dr. Oz here. I've got Lisa in the studio with me, talking to Ron Santo, baseball hero, played in the big leagues for 14 years as a Cub. Talks a lot in this old Cub about the story of how he played in the major leagues as a, you know, big-time star with juvenile diabetes, a condition which no one at the time as a position player had played with. And again, if you think back to managing diabetes in the 50s and 60s, it was a whole different ballgame. You couldn't even tell what your blood sugar was. I think one thing you do very nicely is serve as a role model to a lot of folks with chronic disease. You've actually been doing a lot of work with the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. I'd love to hear a little bit about your perspectives and what they're accomplishing, but you know, how does it feel to be a role model in this capacity? Very different from that as a player.
I got involved in 1976, I think it was, and there was no monies going towards diabetes research up until 1974. And it's amazing what has happened since then, with the glucometer, the insulin pump, so many wonderful things. And I started a walkathon. And the walkathon was my first walkathon. We raised about $60,000. And the following year, we were like $100,000. Then we started to expand. Instead of asking monies from corporation, we asked for bodies to go out and walk and pledge. And now I've got five walks on a Sunday, and every year in October, and we've raised $5 million over the last 6 years, 5.8 2 years ago. So it's like my walks have raised about $60-65 million.
That's incredible.
It is.
That's
it really
incredible.
Is.
Hey John, why don't you take it from here?
You know, this is such an opportunity for me because I was telling you before the show, I was one of those kids that used to wait in the corner like 40 years ago when all the Cubs used to drive down the street and stop and sign autographs and things like that. And the thing that intrigued me most about the 69 Cubs team, even though it broke our hearts, was that you guys, there was a certain resilience and a certain strength of character that to this day is obvious whenever you meet those guys. And I wondered how much, as I was watching This Old Cub, which is a DVD, if you're listening to the Dr. Oz Show, you got to pick it up. It's at www.thisoldcub.com. You can go there, and a portion of the proceeds go to JDRF, I believe.
Yes.
But when I was watching the DVD, I realized that, you know, the challenges that you went through, having your prosthetic legs put on, all that, I didn't hear any whining or complaining. It was like, hey, let's get this over with and let's move on. And I watched the other patients that are in the DVD kind of looking at you for that kind of strength. I mean, have you always have that? Is that what you call on to get through all this stuff?
You know what? I'm very proud that I'm able to inspire a lot of people. I love people. I'm a guy that likes to sign autographs, say hello to everybody. I recall when I was 12 years old, and I've said this a lot, my mother used to say, treat people the way you want to be treated. And I've always felt that way. I let them know that until something drastically happens to you, you do what you have to do. And that's what I did. I didn't think I was not going to get through this. In fact, I felt strong about it. I was out of baseball. I didn't need to play baseball anymore. I was in good financial state. I felt like my main concern was staying alive, no doubt about it. Mm. And so it's an attitude. There's only one way you can go, because if you decide to feel sorry for yourself, that doesn't work. So you know, it's a positive type thing. And I've always had that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, because I know that anybody in Chicago and people in baseball, the record that you had, the amount of home runs you hit for third baseman, the things that you did all the years on the field, we all want you to be in Cooperstown. And the last couple times that hasn't happened. But when the interviews came, I'm sure there must have been some disappointment, but it seems like you had the same mentality about what was going on for the Hall of Fame as you did what was going on with your health. It's like, okay, what's my next challenge?
That's exactly right. And you know, my health has always been a challenge. I mean, I've had a lot. And, you know, when you look at diabetes, it's a very insidious disease, as Dr. Oz mentioned the fact. And I'm very fortunate. I'm 69 years old. And to be able to feel as good as I'm feeling and walking without any aid, you know, it's a frame of mind. But hey, I get worried when something comes up, you know, a sore here or there.
Yeah.
And it's just my life. I don't think about it once I get in that booth. And when I'm doing the games, nothing's on my mind but the Cubbies.
Yeah, I don't know where you guys come up with half the stuff you do.
Oh, it's crazy.
You. Of course, you and Pat Hughes in there doing the Chicago Cub games on WGN. But past, you know, the challenge of the health thing, you know, I'm a very well-fit 50-year-old guy. But when I watched this old Cub, not only did I think about what it was like when I was 10 and what, you know, kind of hope is all about, because really baseball is the field of dreams.
Yeah.
If you're a kid in America, whether you're a girl or a boy, and you watch baseball, you go out to the ball game, you're 10 again. Do you feel like that even now, Ron, when you go to do baseball? Are you back when you were a kid?
Oh, absolutely. I've been a kid all my life. I really have. When I'm up in that booth, I'm like on the field. That's why...
is that why they're always pulling you back?
That's
in
That's exactly right. It's almost like I don't realize most of my vocabulary is, oh, no.
I know.
Oh, what's going on?
Listen, wait. After there's a ball game, John Keith and the rest of us from Rock Runner go, did you hear what he did this week? It was like, oh, my God. You know, we love that.
Well, that's me. I'm not, you know, that's the way I am. And, of course, Pat Hughes, we just have such a wonderful time together, great chemistry, and he is brilliant.
Mm. What do you think about the sport today? Because it's so easy to get lost in the money and the things like that. I know you spend a lot of time around the players. What's your read on kind of how, you know, has steroid controversy hurt the game? Are we back? You know, kind of what's the state of the game in the 21st century?
Well, I don't think, you know, I don't like the steroid situation. It did offend baseball quite a bit. But I don't think about it. I think the players today, I talked about this the other day, that there is more pressure on these players than when I played. Because I feel like when I played from 1960 to 74, that it was the love of the game. Nobody worried about, and you had a one-year contract. So there was big incentives to do well, stay away from the trainer's room.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Because
there, every team had 20 minor league teams, and there was players that can
wait to
come
take
up
your place
and take your job. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. I think today, though, with all the money, it's put a lot more pressure on these players, and they have no privacy.
You know what I find interesting in Chicago, and I would guess this is like any city that loves their team, you're up one day and you're down the next. But it seems like that's only been the last 10 or 15 years because of free agency. Back in the day, everybody stayed here. They lived here. You guys had off-season jobs here. You know where you're really part of the community. Now, they don't need to do those things. They're paid so well. What about that sense of community? Have we lost something in the game because of that?
Well, I think so. To me, there was no free agency stuff. So we were together. Billy and Ernie and I were together for 14 years. Well, Ernie 12 and Billy 14. And we had a team that was together for 9 straight years, the 69 team. Mm-hmm. And, and people recognize us because they don't have to look at the number. They can just look at us because we've been there so long. So we related to the fans. And today, the ball player makes a lot of money. The incentive to do better only comes when there's a free agent and he's getting big bucks and then he's going to have to move it up a notch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a little bit different, but they've got a lot of great ball players.
What about the role model responsibility? By the way, John St. Augustine sitting, we kicked Dr. Oz out because he's from New York. And you and I don't like New York very much, do we, after 1969?
I know.
What about the role model responsibility or that piece of baseball? Because it is a little bit different because of the sense of community changing, is that, like it or not, young kids look up to the Aramis Ramirez's and the Derek Lees and anybody else, the Prince Fielders, wherever they may play. Is there a responsibility that has to be taught to these young guys? Do they have it like you guys did?
Yeah, we really did. I mean, we related, as I said, to the fans. Players today don't relate like we do, but they do care. They give a lot of charities. It's a different mix. And when you look at a role model, it's how you conduct yourself off the field, and that's important. I mean, let's face it, the steroid situation didn't help baseball or individuals. Today there's so much going on, and I personally, John, I just feel like I love being out there. I love doing the games. I'd like to see guys in the clubhouse with great chemistry, and we have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a strong believer that you got to have chemistry in that clubhouse to take it out in the field.
Yeah. What do people come up to you and say most when they run into Ron Santo? Is it about overcoming and working with diabetes? I mean, what do you hear most from people about your legacy or your life, not just in Chicago, but in sports?
About my health
and
what I overcame and the Cubs, of course, mm-hmm. everywhere I go. And I'm willing to talk about the Cubs. I love it.
Yeah, we couldn't tell. I know you're a little shy about the Cubbies. The thing about it is when you do the radio, I think all of us follow you there because, look, our hearts have been broken since 69.
Yes.
And every year you say it's this year, we all believe you, know,
yes.
So and you believe it.
Well, there's no doubt about it.
Is this our year?
I'll tell you this. this is my 20th year with the Cubs.
Yes.
This is definitely the best team I've broadcast this year. And Jim Henry did a wonderful job. He didn't stand still. He went out and brought what Lou Piniella wanted, some more left-handed hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're solid. As long as we stay healthy, I feel this is the year. I'm optimistic, no doubt about it. But the last 3 years, you win 2 divisional titles.
Yes.
2. And now we're on our way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the confidence is building.
Well, at the fear of turning this into a sports talk show, I can go for an hour. I want to talk, just bring it down into the micro for you. So you've done some amazing things with your life. You've had businesses. You have an opportunity to talk to people about diabetes through the DVD, This Old Cub. You're in the broadcast booth. I know you spend a lot of time around the young players talking about how to play the game and all those type of things. Your son Ron and I have known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
It's great to see him again and all these different things. But really, if I say Ron Santo's legacy is, what does it really boil down to? Who are you and what is it that you're here to do and leave us with?
That's a question that I feel my everyday life is me. In other words, I love people. I care about them. And I love the game of baseball. What I'm going to leave is the inspiration, and believe me, I don't look at, I'm blessed to have that, and I love it. I mean, you just love it. When I can make somebody smile, that's what it's all about. And just a guy that cares about everybody else.
Last question. I mean, we can all sit back and, you know, I can't get through the Field of Dreams without wiping my face, you know, because it's an amazing thing to have a catch with your dad or whatever. But baseball and life mirror each other a lot. Is there one big lesson from baseball that people listening to the show can put in their life? Is there one thing about the game that even if you don't play for the Cubs or never make it to the Hall of Fame and you're a fan, you can take baseball and say, this is how life can be as well? What's the big gift that baseball gives us?
Well, I think it takes away I think people that come to Wrigley Field and with this economy and everybody having problems and they come to that ballpark, Wrigley Field, and watch the Cubbies, they don't have a bad thought on their mind. They're very happy. I think Wrigley Field makes you feel good. The electricity in there, the tradition. I think that's the best out you can have, you know, to get away from just sitting and thinking about the problems you have and go out there and enjoy your life.
Number 10 for 14 years with the Chicago Cubs. Your flag is hanging up on the mast with all the other great ones. And, Ron, it's a thrill for me. 10 years old, waiting on the corner, waiting for autographs. I told your son, I said, I lost that ball long ago, so you're going to have to sign another one for me if you don't mind.
I wouldn't mind a bit.
I left all the Oprah accoutrements in there for a couple of reasons. One is it's kind of nice to hear that stuff again. Seven people really built that channel from nothing on XM back in the day. We started in 06. I was there till 10, and it was a daunting task. You know, you're taking the largest, at that time, the largest name in the world, basically, branding-wise, and you have to create a product that reflects that. So we had our work cut out for us, no doubt. And the folks that I worked with, we each kind of had our own expertise and experience. I was the only one on the crew that was a talk radio host and a producer. Everybody else was more of in the production mode and things like that. So I was able to work with these folks as a coach. And it was a lot of fun and a lot of challenge, too. I mean, Mehmet Oz, at the time, was the number one heart surgeon in the world. And when we first got him in the studio, I'll never forget it, New York. We fly to New York everybody's kind of pairing up with people. You know, Corny Cole went to work with Gail King, who's now on CBS in the mornings doing news. And I already knew Gene Chatsky from my previous show in Michigan. So, you know, that was a no-brainer that she and I would work together. And quite frankly, everybody was a little intimidated with Oz because he was the shining star. He was the one that was bringing if you remember back in the day when he was on the Oprah show, he would bring like livers and gizzards out and all kind of stuff. And that endeared him to the audience. So he was a little bit of an intimidating guy because of that and because of the fact that he's, you know, this heart surgeon, well-renowned, and you got to deal with a guy like that at a certain level, and I didn't have a problem with that. I've never seen anybody that I really couldn't work with. You just got to figure out what the mechanisms are. So he and I hit it off, become great friends, worked together for those 4 years, and at that time, it was just a really interesting experience to put all that together. After this interview aired, again, I'd have to go dig for the date, but I'm guessing 08, 09. For the next 3 or 4 years, I didn't have to get Cub tickets over the counter. He was so generous. My buddy Johnny Keith and I probably went to a dozen or more home games. Of course, this is long before the World Series, but it was so generous of him to do that. I mean, he had us in the dugout, my son and I in the dugout. And we went to the games, and we went to the booth with him and Pat Hughes, and he was so generous. And for a kid like me who grew up with him just pulling over, you know, at the corner and arm's distance away, this was just, it was unbelievable. And he would always push it off. John, don't worry about it. You know, thanks so much for all you do. Don't worry about it. Just a great guy. So, you know, it was very sad to get the news that Ron had passed away, but this is a guy who made such a huge impact even outside of baseball. I think that's the big aha, the big get for me. You know, he took something that was a detriment that is difficult for the people who suffer with diabetes, and he used it to raise money that is still helping research long after he's gone. You know, he has legs amputated and never complained. So when I think of the little things here and there, you know, that I may, I got an ache here or ache there. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, I mean, seriously went through the ringer. So I hope you enjoyed that little clip. Baseball season is rolling around. You know, the game is, I think, a lot different than it was when Ron played. The money's ridiculous and all the rest of it. And quite frankly, I have a more difficult time supporting that. I don't go to the games anymore at Wrigley Field. I'm a huge Cubs fan, but, you know, the business has changed it for me. I guess that's inevitable. I don't think you can put the toothpaste back in the tube once it's out, and so many things that kind of got out in baseball in general and here in Chicago as well. But it's good to hear this again for me and to kind of roll back the clock a little bit and listen to number 10 talk about the glory days of baseball. Hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, take care. Oh, by the way, there's a programming note. I almost forgot this. If you're interested, and I hope you are, two things are happening tomorrow on Sunday at 10 o'clock Chicago time. The Tao of Music, which is a show that I do in Washington, D.C., is online live. And then goes into repeats the whole week. And then 2 hours later, at 1 o'clock Eastern time, a new show that I'm working with, Jennifer Weigel, the vaunted and highly respected journalist, called John and Jen. That launches on WCRW in Washington. It'll be online across the board as well. So I always post that stuff on my Facebook page. If you, and this is so great. Listen, I've known Jennifer Weigel 25 years. And we've talked thousands of hours behind the scenes. We've done some work together on the air, but this is a chance for us to kind of do a little bit of a tug of war, a little back and forth. You know, we kind of have two different viewpoints on things, but we're going to the same direction eventually. So excited to work with her. Those are both tomorrow at WCRW. You can find those at www.newworldradio.com. 10 o'clock Central Time is the music show, and noon Central Time is the John and Jen show. So looking forward to all that. Getting kind of busy over here. Thanks for sticking with me. I sure appreciate the subscribers that make this all happen. Until next time, take care. Safe travels. Adios.